And now it's time for wait a minute. What the hell is the show called again?
It's Chatter on Books. What else do you want me to say? Can I go now?
That's right. It's Chatter on Books. Let's do this thing.
Let's do this thing indeed. Welcome back to Chatter on Books.
23, baby.
This is episode 23?
23.
It's the Michael Jordan episode.
It is. In fact, Michael Jordan will be joining us in
there
the third
go.
Hour.
There you go.
Does he have a book?
Not yet.
Okay.
It's a book. I was really good. I was better than all of you.
I really, really was good.
He was really good.
Are you GOT watchers?
No.
So there's a current meme that has Aria as the Jumpman. It's fantastic.
Yes. It's fantastic.
Every team in sports announced today they were signing her. I don't watch, but I assume she's a person of some importance.
She did something really important.
I went into last night's episode hoping she died in last night's episode, and then you go, yes. Oh, yeah. It was great.
Yes,
great
it was.
Moment. Tony isn't into GOT at all, is he?
No, not into
That's
fantasy.
Too bad. That's too bad. It's great.
One dragon, no Tony.
There is a resemblance, though, to the Night King.
We're down to one. We're down to one dragon, right?
We have two dragons. We don't know what happened to the third now that the Night King is...
Well, I think the Night King's dragon,
the Night King's dragon disintegrated.
Is no more. And it looked like one of the other dragons was out. But now I have talked to the GM, and it's just doubtful for the next
there
match.
You go.
So
trying to keep
just
going to
miss
from,
one start.
Yes.
Right. Trying to keep it remotely on books. Has anybody read Fire and Ice?
Yes.
You did?
Yeah, I've read.
God bless
I've
you.
I've read. I think everyone but the last book.
Did you like them?
I did. I liked them enormously. I read them pretty much when they first came out. I like epic fantasies if they're done well. If they're not, it's like you like put your head through a concrete wall. And this one was done very well. And again, when you're reading it, you're like going along. This is hundreds of pages. The book is like 1,000 pages. You're like, oh, this is about Ned Stark. Oh, this is going to be – okay, it's not – oh, it's
no.
about his son, Rob.
Don't
okay,
get attached.
Oh, wow, yeah. And so – and I found that intriguing. The problem was when the show came out, he stopped writing. And so there was like a 7-year gap between books. And I said – hey, pal, I got stuff to do. I moved on. Yeah.
I saw him interviewed, though. How does he feel that the show went on? The show has gone on longer than his books did. And he just said, you know, they paid their money. They own it. It's their baby now. They get to do what they want.
I think he's happy.
But he's had fun in interviews where he said, I could always bring characters back from the dead.
Yes.
That's right.
Yes, he can.
Because the show's relatively tame compared to the written series.
Yeah. Yeah.
The Night King's not going to come back.
No.
I never say never.
Amnesia. Okay. I'm digressing here so I don't get to the book report time.
Yeah, I noticed you saw in there.
Got Mark, and we've got David Aldridge and Michael, and we have Bill Isaacson here who played a very important role in tonight's show. Because tonight's show, we are going to have, among other things, we're going to have 4 of the 10 authors of Yes, She Can, 10 Stories of Hope and Change from young female staffers of the Obama White House.
I think
four
I see
of whom
some
are
of
here.
I think I see a quadrant.
Including Andrea, who is your associate at the law firm, right, Bill? Yeah, so thank you for making this happen. Colleague, I'm
colleague.
Sorry. I get those law words wrong. But thank you for making this happen. If it doesn't go well, it's all your fault.
Yeah, it's all you, Bill.
Exactly.
They were telling me about they've been on media tours, and the book has been very, very successful. It is a bestseller. We are thrilled to have them. Bill, thank you very much for that. Couple of other things we're going to do. We are going to do a little crossfire, which is based on a story I read in the Post last week. Is censorship ever okay?
Mm-hmm.
It seems like there's an obvious answer to that, but maybe there isn't. And in the Deserted Island segment, instead of taking a book, take an author or two.
Mm-hmm.
If you could only take one or two authors with you to the Deserted Island, who would you take?
Mm-hmm.
Little Housekeeping, Calvert Woodley, over there today.
CW.
Talking to the gang. Michael Sands is terrific. He and I check in first thing Monday morning. How's your weekend? What do you got? He always asks who we have on. He was telling about our authors and these young women who have written this incredible book and had these great experiences. So he comes up with this lovely wine. Bill, maybe you could help. We'll tip you well if you actually serve as waiter as well.
I like it.
It's called Oceane. It's a Chardonnay. It comes out of a vineyard which is owned and run by Rachel Martin. David, does this name ring a bell?
Name rings a bell.
Because Jack Kent Cook's stepdaughter, when Jack Kent Cook sold the Redskins to Dan Snyder.
Well, he didn't sell them to Dan Snyder.
Well, okay. he put a lot of his money into Boxwood Vineyard out in Middleburg, Virginia.
Okay, yes, the square.
And
of
Rachel Martin worked there and got into the wine business, and really is one of the real stars behind Virginia vineyards in general, Middleburg in particular. And this does not come out of Virginia. This 2016 Chardonnay comes out of California, but it was the New Orleans International Wine Awards, 2018 Double Gold Medal winner, 2019 Hilton Head Island Wine and Food Festival International Wine Competition Gold Medal winner, and it's really lovely, and it's a great story, and he thought it would be great to have a woman-owned vineyard represented here tonight, so
boom.
Thank you for that.
Done.
And then we have a cheese, which, Michael, you seem to like the cheese.
Great cheese.
Great cheese. Wow. You seldom get a great from Michael.
Mm-mm.
It is Oso Irate. May not be a well-known cheese. I think that's probably safe to say. But it is from the Basque region of France. And it's known as the grandfather of Basque cheeses. How would you describe it, Michael?
Semi-soft, very mild, but just, you know, I'm hoping for a few more tasting notes from them, but very good.
Okay, there you go. It comes from small, creamy brown sheep. Yeah, well, I always go right to the animal because they've made their contributions. Yes. Thank you.
Small, creamy brown sheep.
Yeah. And it's one of the...
A little bit of laminate. A hint of lamb.
So that's where the color comes from.
Yeah.
One of the first, I don't know what this line means, but they're notes Michael gave me. One of the first intentionally made cheeses in Europe. Because I guess a lot of cheese was kind of accidental.
Did you leave that out too long?
Leave the milk out, yeah.
Did you leave it out too long? Let's try and eat it.
Possibly dating back to 3000 BC. But
possibly.
Thank you, Michael and CW.
Maybe not. We don't know.
And just if you go to CW at 4339 Connecticut Avenue and go to their great wines and liquors and La Cheeserie, and if you say Chatter 5 at checkout, you get $5 off. So go there.
I'm so embarrassed you saw me stuffing my face with the cheese.
Several times.
To the point where I couldn't even get
several
tasting notes.
Several times.
Yeah, and before we
taste like cheese.
Before we fully enter the show, we are here indeed at Chatter.
Yes.
On the corner of Wisconsin and Jennifer in French Hip Heights. This is a for-profit business.
That's right.
This is the only place you want to come for breakfast, lunch, or dinner.
Used
or
to be
cocktails.
A great place to watch the Caps.
Used to be.
Yeah, but you
we'll
see, that
be
flag,
again in
see that flag waving out there?
I believe we're flying the W.
Yes, the Nats.
Oh, we moved on.
The curly W, baby. Yeah. You have to.
Man,
you have
the
to.
King is dead.
You're right.
13 TVs.
The under 500 cap, the under 500 Nats.
Yeah.
Takes time.
Okay.
Takes time.
Now we're going to skitter right past the book report.
No, we're not, actually.
Just to remind people, David gave me the choice of three books. Adoring fans picked Invisible Man. Got 39% of the vote. I'm reading it. Michael talked a little bit earlier. Just the beginning of the book, you're just dumbstruck by how much happens in the beginning of the book. I keep finding myself, I'll read something and go, well, I wonder where that came from. And I start doing research around it,
mm-hmm.
just like I did when you were doing yours on mm-hmm. Cuckoo's Nest, the research around it. So one of the stories, and I found it in several different places, so it must be true, is Ellison went home to Oklahoma. He was attending Tuskegee, went home. He's in a barbershop, and he's hanging out waiting to get his haircut. And he picks up an Esquire magazine. And in those days, this is 1950-ish, because the mm-hmm. book came out in 52. In those days, Hemingway would write pieces for Esquire. And Ellison reads these, is inspired by how Hemingway wrote about the things that Hemingway wrote. And one of the things Ellison said in interviews was, if Hemingway could write with such clarity, with such power about catching a fish, then I need to bring the same power, the same clarity to what I'm writing about.
Mm-hmm.
So that's delayed my book report a little bit, Professor Aldridge, but I'm working on it.
If you are looking back into the book, for those who are listening at home, as you're looking
Invisible Man,
I've not read the book in about a decade, but there's two early scenes. One includes what happens where these young men on scholarship have to go before their admittance. And you try and transpose this scene into 2019, we say, oh, well, there's no way this would ever happen. It could, and it does, just change the scene. It might not be sort of a feat of strength, a fight, but it might be, say, a dinner party where you are thanking those kind gentlemen who have allowed for this scholarship to happen. When you take a look at the back and forth with the president, and when you discover what is actually in the president of this university's letter, it is jaw-dropping.
Yeah. It's absolutely jaw-dropping, and I'm just in the first maybe third of the book, and I mm-hmm. think, my God. So it's really phenomenal, and I'm glad I'm working on it. It will just take some time.
Okay.
It's Aldridge. A difficult read.
Yeah, it is.
It seems like you spend a lot of time coming up with stuff to give us instead of the actual report.
That would be true.
Maybe.
Yes, that would be true. That would be very true.
I say this because you and I are cut from the same cloth.
Yes. The lack of academic cloth? Would it be that cloth?
Stern, where is that paper?
Oh, man.
Funny story about that.
And
Did you know where paper came from?
Yeah. It's fascinating story.
Do you know what a pencil is, Miss Clark? I heard that once or twice. Yeah. Okay. But it's really wonderful. And just as when you were working on yours, David, I loved what I was learning along the way as you were working on it. Mm-hmm. It's really something. We'll move on. But his bravery of writing what he wrote in the early 1950s was remarkable. Yeah. Absolutely remarkable. And he got the National Book Award for Fiction in 1953. Mm-hmm. And awards now, they throw out a million awards and they become less and less significant. But it must have been pretty significant for him to get the award he got in 1953. Sure. When you think about what else was going on.
Yeah, and that's why I'm always moved by what people did then, not what they're doing now.
Because then it was tough.
Then it was a lot harder.
It's a little different. Stakes were a little higher.
A lot harder to do what he did. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, from wonderful to, it's not a ridiculous topic, but I'm going to call this segment, Is It Ever Okay to Ban the Bunny? So last week, it was actually the Washington Post, a reliable source, had an article. To take everybody back, Vice President Pence's wife and her daughter wrote a book about their pet bunny. Mm-hmm. And John Oliver thought this was hilarious. So he did, and the staff at his show did a takeoff on it. The gay Marlon Brando story. The bunny's name is Marlon Brando. The Pence family does this cute book, kids book about Marlon Brando. He does the gay Marlon Brando story in which Marlon Brando finds a guy and they get married. And this is every year the American Library Association, the ALA, tracks books that people have gone to libraries in schools, public libraries, mm-hmm. and say, you need to ban this book. Mm-hmm. And this is the second most requested banned book on that list, which so far most people have declined
to do.
The John Oliver version mm-hmm. of it. Okay. Yeah. There's a sequel coming out to the Pence Bunny book, so I'm hoping this means that we get a sequel from John Oliver as well. But it's pretty remarkable that they even have to do this. The majority of books, it's usually in the high 300s, 400s, mm-hmm. that people request or ban have to do with LGBTQ issues.
Of course.
That tend to be most of them. But when you read stories about this over the years, we've talked about this. Mark Twain, mm-hmm. right? Huckleberry Finn. Lots and lots of books people have requested they should be banned. Right.
Lady Chatterley's Lover. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. And I'm going to go to Michael on this first.
Catcher in the Rye.
Yeah.
Right. Manifesto.
Yeah.
Right.
You're the one among us who has most recently spent the time with young people. We'll focus on that. Should books in school libraries ever be banned?
Yes, but this is an impossible question. If you have a book that is going to incite violence, is going to encourage physical violence, mm-hmm. then it is your responsibility to the community to take that out. But you have to ask by whom and for whom. By whom? Who's actually going to be the person banning this? Who's making that decision? Because I think more of us need to be aware of what's actually being taught inside of our schools. And we need to remember, at some point, a committee got together and said, these five books are in, these five are out, and you want to keep asking why. When are we rotating them? Is it because one teacher who has, say, 20 years of experience doesn't want to change the worksheets that he or she has been producing for the last 10 years?
Right.
Is there a reason why this is in the curriculum now? In terms of most of the books that we have that are entering this banned or should it be banned list, there's a good reason why they're brought up, and that's because there's value in them. And we need to try and unpack where that value is and how we can get to that conversation around it. Let's look at Catcher in the Rye as a very good example. You can say you don't like the book. You can say it doesn't need to be taught in a modern classroom. That's fine. But that's different than saying categorically this book is inappropriate to be in a high school because certain kids have identified with it in a way where they have acted out. Because there's going to be a whole other list of children who have identified with that and said, finally, I have a character, I have a voice that actually understands where I'm coming from and that recognizes what I'm going through. Mm-hmm. And you also have to think through, the easy example would be, well, the kids are going to be exposed to it anyway. You know, we have video games, we have the internet. So is there a way where we can try and do this in a structured way so that when a kid is reading the first chapter of Catcher in the Rye and feels completely separated from the rest of the school on essentially a school holiday and crosses the road and feels himself to be disappearing, how can we try and get to the root of the cause, which may have something to do with family, with just personal development, with being maybe delayed developmentally? Mm-hmm. How can we try and get to that question rather than this book encourages someone to think about sex for the first time, so let's get it out of the school library?
So without saying which school at which you taught, can you say the kinds of books that you decided we're not going to have those in our library?
It's not so much that a book would be banned in the way that we're thinking for these searches, because I think
feature them in your teaching.
You would not necessarily feature them in your teaching, and sometimes it would be the books that I taught for my juniors and seniors. A good example would be Goodbye Columbus, which explores sort of understanding your own sexuality. Mm-hmm. And I remember we had a tour group come through. It's 8:15 in the morning, and you're looking at Brenda and Neil's relationship, trying to understand what does sex mean for these young adults who are entering their young adulthood. They're figuring out who they are. They're moving away from families. They're getting their first jobs. And all of a sudden, I look up, and I've got a 15-year-old boy taking a tour of the school with his parents. Mm-hmm. And time and place. That's not necessarily the appropriate time for that student to be, say, subjected to that mm-hmm. piece. Mm-hmm. But no, more the other side to this would be you have ban is a very direct and purposeful word. You have passive,
and the people
you
who
have
go...
a passive banning of books by just having a different group of, say, scholars deciding, well, this book has value, and we've talked about what it means to be part of, say, the canon and not. And sometimes you have to say, well, is there pushback of trying to be too outside the box or too broad, mm-hmm. where you might not necessarily have the skill set in teachers to, say, teach a very niche subject, geographical location, people, cultural movement, or period.
Yeah.
So like Invisible Man, I've read that book. I find it incredibly powerful. I don't have the wherewithal to do a look at, say, the Harlem Renaissance and to look at mm-hmm. a full unit of poetry and Invisible Man and taking a look at what, as we come back to that first third, I don't have an understanding of HBCs in a way that would make that a meaningful teaching lesson.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. David?
No is the answer. No is the answer. But I'm an absolutist. I'm a journalist.
Yeah.
I kind of believe the First Amendment's kind of important. So, and that doesn't make me right. It makes me what I am. And I just simply cannot think of a circumstance under which I would say a book, no matter how repulsive the subject matter, or how adult the subject matter, is not worth at least being available.
Yeah.
Now there are books that should not be simply left in the stacks for a kid to pull out. Mm-hmm.
Such as,
I mean, Mein Kampf, for example, would be an example of that. You need somebody to kind of walk you through that to make you understand what that is about. And the person who wrote it, you know. Yeah. So
I'm closer to you than I am to Michael. But listening to Michael, I say, okay, there's a difference between banning and in a school choosing not to focus on something and not
spend
time on it.
Yeah,
but
I don't think we're on opposite sides at all.
I'm with you, and I can't think of a case in which people shouldn't have access to a book. And I think, especially public libraries, and I think, you know, as the mother of raising three kids in Chevy Chase, Maryland, where they're exposed to so much, I want them exposed to as many experiences as possible. Or I want the young kid who is questioning his sexuality be able to read a book in a library that might help him understand if he's not getting that help or support from his family. So I think books are an incredibly safe place to experience a million different things, even if it's things that are violent, hateful, like Mein Kampf.
Right, and you have to walk them through it. That's all. If you can say, if you want to read this, you can read it, but we're going to talk about it after. We're going to talk about while you're reading it. You're not going to just be left to your own devices.
Yeah, Mark.
I think all books should be banned. Yeah. I've said this for a number of years.
Because then that would be the end of the show, which Mark would be going, yeah!
Take a nap.
More free time.
No, I'm with you, David. I don't think there's any circumstances under which a book should be banned. I think the effort to do those things, and I agree with you, Michael. I can see some, I don't want to say censoring because that's too strong a word, but sort of massaging it from a faculty standpoint and saying, well, let's focus on these
as
opposed to
everything.
These.
And not
these.
Right.
I understand that.
Right. And I think that's totally legit. But in response to these people that are writing in, and this book needs to get banned, this is hate that offends me and all this stuff.
A gay bunny. I personally think all bunnies are gay.
To me, it smacks of this stuff of safe zones and trigger words and all this stuff, and this attempt to sort of protect you from things that might challenge the way you think inevitably defeats you because it limits your view of the world and your experiences with the world. And I think the idea, once you start going down that slope of, well, this is just inappropriate, or this is something we don't want people. No, then the doors will totally wide open. No, it's the First Amendment thing.
Well,
for me.
You can challenge any book, right?
I mean,
yeah. Really,
you could. And because so we in on you know April of 2019 might feel a certain way about a certain topic,
right?
And 50 years from now, people might look at us and be like, "You guys were barbarians.
Yeah,
you were savages. How could you possibly have that worldview?
How could you watch that show, Game of Thrones, with dragons? How could you?"
Okay. Well, and as soon as you challenge that book, that's where the learning happens. It's going to be in that subsequent conversation where you're throwing it. I often say you're trying to throw this back into your own experiences as you're trying to, say, unwrap or figure out these difficult questions.
Yeah.
But then I come back to that example that I gave early on in our show, with Huck Finn, which is one of the books that comes back time and time again. And I taught this for 2 or 3 years, and I look back and I wonder about the harm that I unknowingly did on certain students of color who had difficulty reading that text. And I was an idealistic young teacher saying, we're going to confront this. This is a, you know, using, this is the room where it's safe to do that. No, I can't say that.
Yeah. And can they teach Invisible Man in a high school now?
I don't know. I haven't been in high school in 40 years. So I can't answer that question.
I think that is a tough book.
Tough book.
So we read that book when I was a high school senior, and I think I was still too young to understand that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went to a predominantly white school. This was in an African-American literature class that was probably the most balanced in terms of backgrounds and experiences. And even then, it was a difficult, difficult read.
We get to, but the whole nature of education, and you are an expert. I am a novice, comparatively speaking. I always feel like any exposure is better than no exposure.
I agree.
And so,
even if it's not perfect exposure,
yeah,
there's no such
and
thing
so
as perfect.
Even though you can read something and go, you know what, this is a I can appreciate this work on its merits as a work, while not being able to understand the significance of all of it.
Right.
I think that's fine. I mean, I don't, the Joy Luck Club, that's not probably my experience, but it was a really good book. I understand it was a good book, even though, even as I also understand, it will not move me probably the way it would move other people.
Yeah.
And I think that's okay. I don't think that there's anything wrong with that.
Okay. I've written something down, so this is for just the folks here in studio. This
we're ready.
This is the only thing I would ban. I think you guys can all agree with this. Right?
Okay. So our ban list includes Pumping Irony, Back from More Cash.
No.
And Salty the Sea Cat.
You know, someday we have to have him on. He has to come on.
Who, Tony?
As an author. Yes.
I would think so.
Yeah.
Well.
Yeah. And that.
You want to make that ask?
Absolutely.
We did.
Yes, I will.
I'll give you 15 minutes.
All right. Speaking of authors, we're gonna take a break, and we will come back with 4 of the 10 authors of Yes, She Can, 10 Stories of Hope and Change from Young Female Staffers of the Obama White House. And we'll be back in just a sec.
And welcome back to Chatter on Books on this gorgeous Monday afternoon. Gorgeous because it's not raining or snowing.
That's true.
I'll take it.
I'm in the power chair now.
You are.
This is awesome.
Yes.
Issuing orders.
I have to pass the microphone over to Tori.
We're sharing. Many reasons we're sharing is because
I'm feeling balder and richer.
You look good sitting
Thank
up there.
You.
You can take over the show anytime. We are very lucky this evening to have not one but 4 authors of the book Yes, She Can. And we have 4 very, very talented people who are going to share their stories with us tonight. But I have to again thank Bill Isaacson. Thank you very much. Colleague, that is the correct word, Bill?
Yes.
Colleague of Andrea Flores, one of our authors. And I'm going to, for the sake of time, because one of us has to catch a flight soon, I'm going to stick to first names. So we have Andrea, we have Kalisha, we have Nita, and we have Taylor. Thank you so much for being with us. You guys, I know, have been all over the country talking about this book, Yes, She Can. I always go immediately to logistics, and it is hard, ladies, for 3 people to decide what movie they are going to go see. How did you get yourselves organized to write this book, and how did you keep it? Each chapter is well written. Each chapter is tight. It's focused. They have purpose. How did you ever get this book organized?
I think we have to thank our fearless leader, Molly Dillon, who compiled the book. She's really the one that wrangled us. And I think both our editor and our literary agent have also been extraordinary in kind of helping corral us. And so our editor really did the majority of the work behind making sure our stories were tight and concise and helping us kind of find our similar voices and shared stories in a good way.
How did Molly convince you to do this? Because often some people we know come out of White Houses and go, okay, let's tell all, let's sell my story. How did she convince you to do this?
I think for many of us, it was the mission of the book. It was all about just encouraging and inspiring more young women and girls of color to get into public service and politics and government and sort of demystify what those spaces look like. And so I think we really just got behind what that mission was.
There's a very clear theme to it, and that comes across. So, Andrea, you were the first Latinx student body president at Harvard. And in your own words, tell me if I'm saying this wrong, but in your own words, you talk about at Harvard, you face problems about your race, about your gender. And
Yes.
I spend a lot of time at the IOP at Harvard. We could talk for days. You get to the White House. Did you find that environment in some ways easier?
Yes. So I think I call my time with the Obama White House very almost sort of racially healing. It was
interesting.
An incredibly diverse space. Compared to any other space I had ever been in since I left. I'm from New Mexico, and so Harvard was a lot of culture shock. The definition of who did politics there was very rigid and longstanding, so it felt really hard to make my mark there. But then I walked into the White House and to the White House immigration team. I write about like the two Latinas I worked for and this incredible white ally, and they just really redefined the way I thought about being a woman of color in politics and really left me with sort of these lifelong lessons of how to show up in professional spaces.
Mm-hmm. You talked about some of the women that inspired and helped you. Felicia Escobar, Sotomayor.
Yes. I mean, I will never forget watching those confirmation hearings. It was after my first semester of being student body president, and I had a rough semester. It was not easy for me. And watching her confirmation hearings was the first time that I saw a very high-profile political woman dealing with issues of identity on the national stage. And people were really critical of her tone and what she may have been saying. And what they were basically doing is saying, you cannot be objective if you're talking about race. And to me, that doesn't make any sense. It's
right.
Part of who you are and it's part of who she is as a judge and a justice. You can't divorce yourself from your identity. So that was really important for me, and it really gave me momentum into my second semester, and I kind of attribute it to giving me some comfort as a leader.
Mm-hmm. Great. I'm going to go alphabetically because I think that's much safer.
Always works.
So, Kalisha, tell me if I'm wrong, but you're currently working on your PhD?
Yes, I am.
Currently working on your PhD. Talk about your PhD and the focus of it and how your work at the White House inspired the course you're following.
Absolutely. So I'm in the sociology department at Yale where I study how both the education system and the criminal and juvenile justice system produce inequities for young people of color and specifically women of color across the country. And I never thought I wanted to get a PhD or be a researcher, but being at the White House directing President Obama's policy portfolio on advancing equity for women and girls of color, you realize that in order to make good policy, you need good research and data. It has to be disaggregated by race and gender. It has to tell the unique story of different communities. And seeing, that there wasn't a lot of that data out there, or when it was out there, it's different when research is done not by a diverse group of people, right? So there are not a lot of women of color, right, in academia doing the research. And so I felt like a lot of the critical questions weren't being asked. And so that's what led me to get my own PhD and to start this very, very long journey.
How long a journey will it be?
You never ask a PhD.
No, you don't. No, you don't.
A long time. I'll see you on the other side.
Come back when you write a book about the research you've done. You were an intern at first at the White House, but you didn't get the internship the first time.
Yes.
You had to knock on the door a couple times,
yes,
right? Tell us about that.
I really love that you asked that and love telling this story. Recently, one of my younger sisters had told me that she was applying. She's an educator in New York and said she was applying to this, prestigious program at Columbia, but she wasn't sure she was going to apply anymore because she didn't want to get rejected. And she looks at me and my sisters, and we never get rejected. protected from anything and we're so successful. And I realized in that moment that I wish I told the story of rejection more often. Sure. People don't do it enough.
Yep.
And so I wish that every university program fellowship that I got rejected from, I had just sent that over her way. So yeah, mm-hmm. I applied to be a White House intern 3 times before being accepted. And sort of my motto was, they might not have seen it the first time, but I know I have a place here. I know the work that I want to do is extraordinarily important. And just to keep knocking on the door until someone answers.
Yeah, and you could make it happen. Okay, again, your words. Tell us about Black Girl Magic in the White House.
Yes. So Black Girl Magic in the White House was this incredible thing of arriving my first day at the White House and thinking that everyone who did politics and policy at the White House was a 40-something-year-old white man, and finding that I got to report to 2 30-something-year-old African-American women who just owned their leadership at the White House. It was, you know, later on becoming a policy advisor with the Council on Women and Girls and reporting to Valerie Jarrett. It was being able to, you know, brief the First Lady before an event and being so intimidated and scared, and then just getting into the room and sitting across from her and seeing that her chocolate brown skin was the same as mine, and her hair frizzed up in the same way that mine did in the D.C. heat. And so it was seeing powerful Black women just across the White House. And I think the most important piece is, and really seconding what Dre said about racial healing, right, in the White House. It was more than just having people of color there, it was the positions that they had. And I think that's really important when we think about diversifying workplaces. It's not just about the number that are there. It's about what role they're playing in decision-making and leadership.
And not experiences either of you had much of before.
Exactly.
Before you got there.
Exactly.
That, pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
Okay, moving along in the alphabet, Nita. So I love reading the backgrounds of all of you. So you studied international relations at Connecticut College.
Yeah.
I almost went there, but I went to GW
really?
Instead. Yeah, I went to GW instead. And you got a master's in energy policy and climate from Johns Hopkins.
I did.
And your first job in Washington, you ended up at the Department of Agriculture?
I did.
How was that?
It was really
interesting.
Culture shock? Definitely a culture shock. Yeah. So I grew up in LA and very liberal kind of town. My parents are both Democrats, very progressive.
So but dairy, crop futures, you can do it all, right?
Definitely not. No, there's not a lot of farming in Los Angeles. But I wasn't really involved in politics growing up. My parents, apart from my knowing that they were both Democrats, we never really talked about politics. We didn't do politics. So getting a job in Washington and being a political appointee was really interesting and surprising in the first place. And then to end up at Ag, where, you know, you have these policies that
the
are...
The good news is you've got a job in Washington.
That's true.
Just kidding.
Very quickly, that was fun. But it was interesting to balance, right? I had these progressive ideals of what I wanted, agriculture and urban agriculture and what that could do for people to look like versus, you know, some of the policies and how they support this institutional agriculture. And both are important, right? We need to feed everyone in our country. But what I was really excited about was more of the progressive policies and seeing how we balance the two was a really interesting space.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things I loved in all of your stories is, of course, you're working in the White House, capital of the free world, big, important things, and clearly a very, very different environment than previous White Houses. But so much of what each of you talked about was just the logistics, the hard freaking work that it takes every single day there. So, Nita, I want to stay with you. You're in the Office of the Staff Secretary, which I understand that's ground zero in a White House.
Yep.
That is freaking ground zero. That is all things important in terms of the President's Day, and you're not supposed to get things wrong. Tell us who was Printy and why Printy was so important.
My coworkers in this office will still love the fact that I named Printy in my chapter. So Printy was this portable printer. I think a lot of the reason we talk about logistics when we talk about the White House is because so many people see some of the glamour sides, right? When an event goes off smoothly or when a trip goes well.
They see the 30 seconds on TV.
Exactly. And they don't, some people just don't understand. And part of what we want to do is demystify like all the hard work that goes into the background of it. And so our job was to make sure, you know, the President's Day ran smoothly and that he had everything he needed to be prepared. And oftentimes, and that meant while he was on travel as well. So oftentimes, you know, you're following the president's schedule. If he's making 6 stops on a trip before getting back on an airplane and never really in an office building, you're still putting together a 60 to 100 plus page briefing book. And that means that you are dealing with no office. You're dealing with printers that may not be connected. You're dealing
literally
with
that on
internet.
The fly.
Yep. literally on the fly. So we had this portable printer, and we all loved him. He is an office member, and we named him Printy. And so he got stickers from everywhere we went, and we carried him around. He was always charged. He was always a third, fourth bag that we were carrying around.
And Printy was a he.
He was a he. I don't know. That yeah. happened before I got there, so...
Just saying.
I might have decided things differently if okay. I got to adopt Prinny first.
So now you work for Enviva,
yes.
right? Renewable energy.
I do, yep.
We were talking a little bit about this before the show. One of the things I always find, and I'll put this on me so you guys are not dissing your current employers, but you leave a place like the White House, or you leave one of these jobs, and you go into the so-called real world. You yeah. go to Bill's law firm. And the things that people in the so-called real world think are crises are sometimes amusing. How was your transition to the so-called real world?
Actually, really amazing. And I will say a big reason behind behind taking this job was the people that I interviewed with and the people that I currently work with. And I think that there's a lot of humility and kindness in this workplace that I didn't expect. Doesn't mean that we don't still, you know, think our hair is on fire a few times a week, if yeah. not a day. But it's been really nice because I think having that really stressful experience beforehand, when my employer hired me, he was like, oh, you could do this in your sleep. Like, this is not hard. I know you have all the skills. And it's really set me up for success in a way that, you know, I've been complimented for keeping my cool while things are on fire. And it's just because I have that perspective, right? Nothing that we do, no mistakes that we make are ending the world. It's,
right.
There's a solution to everything.
Even in briefing books for the President of the United States, things go wrong and the yep. world doesn't end.
Correct.
So once you've been through that and you age 40 years.
Everything's a piece yeah. of cake.
Everything's a piece of cake. Okay. Taylor, saving not the best for last, but yeah. still alphabetical. So you're a UT grad, and to explain where you worked and what you did, I'm going to give you some of your own acronyms.
Okay.
And you have to tell us what the acronyms meant, right?
Yeah.
OFBNB.
Office of Faith-Based and Neighborhood Partnerships.
Good. And one of the big things you worked on and you talked about in the book, Yes, She Can, YOPO, YOPO.
You only pope once. It was at the time that YOLO was trending. So YOPO
seemed
was
really
fitting.
Cute at the
yeah,
time.
Now reflecting,
really cute
it's not
at the time.
As cool.
And trick question BFD, which is related to.
Can I say that?
No.
No, it's a podcast. No.
It's a podcast, you can.
Effing
but, yeah.
deal.
Yeah. So you're in this incredibly important office. It's the visit of Pope Francis, right?
Mm-hmm.
Just 12,000 of your closest friends on the South Lawn.
Yeah.
You are the only Jewish staffer working in the office at the time, right?
Yes.
Hair on fire, 10 million details. How was it?
A lot of details. I will say we had a lot of lead-up time, almost a year to plan this visit.
That's good and bad, though.
It's good, yes.
Right, it is.
The
right.
pain lasts a lot longer.
And what is also good and bad is that there were tons of other offices and federal agencies involved in the logistics and planning of the visit because it was a official state arrival ceremony. So it wasn't just on the OFBNP to pull this off, though we were an integral part of the planning process.
You had to work with, I'm guessing, dozens of different offices.
Yes.
Departments. Everybody wanted a piece of it.
Including,
right?
like, Secret Service. I had never really worked on a policy project with Secret Service before.
Yeah. And photographers
so that was a little intimidating.
Probably Pete Souza taking the great picture of the Pope petting Bo, right?
Yeah.
It's a great photograph. What was the scariest part of putting together that event?
I think just throughout the planning process, just feeling like I was in the right place and I had a right to be there, just generally.
Who gave you, because you all do talk about, it's a common phrase now, the imposter syndrome. Wow, mm-hmm. I don't belong here. I say that all the time with you guys on this show. I don't belong here. imposter syndrome. What gave you or who gave you the inspiration, the courage to say, no, I do belong here, to put on one of the biggest events that this administration is ever going to put on?
For me, it was a lot of times my boss and my friends at work. There was, you know, many times where you felt in over your head and, you know, I was a Jewish staffer in the faith office working on the Pope Francis's visit. And I would rely and remind myself that my friends and coworkers saw something in me. So I should just, if I can't trust myself, find that faith in myself, then I should lean on them to get the confidence I need to go into the meeting or whatever it is.
I think one of the greatest things about working in places like this is you learn the value of asking for help. It's
yes.
never a downside. It's never embarrassing. Mm-hmm. It's never, oh, you're revealing. ask for help, because everybody needs help in those kinds of situations. Okay, these are free-for-all questions, so you fight among yourselves who wants to answer. One of the things that struck me, and the title of the book, we're talking to four of the fabulous authors of Yes, She Can, 10 Stories of Hope and Change from Young Female Staffers of the Obama White House. But in your stories, in your chapters, you talk very little about being women. There's lots about the hard work. Again, I think some people who are not familiar with the White House or working in administration think, oh, it's all grand policies and it's all, oh, it's a meeting with Oprah or we're, you know, meeting with a head of state. And they think it's all up that level. It's so much hard work. Mm-hmm. You all talk so much about the hard work and you talk about race, but there is not much about gender. Is that because it wasn't a factor?
I think gender was definitely a factor, and I think we saw it when many senior women in the Obama White House wrote about this culture that while we were incredibly diverse, there was still a challenge of having senior leaders in the White House, you know, take input from women and vice in the same level. I mean, I think for me personally, my race oftentimes walks ahead of my gendered identity, but I think learning to be a woman in politics, it continues to be, you know, how do you wear your femininity at work? That was actually something I tried to talk about a little bit in my chapter, right? What do you wear to the White House? Mm-hmm. What is professional clothing?
Comfortable shoes.
And
who was it? I'm sorry, we'll come, because this is important. But who talked about the importance of dresses with pockets or clothes with pockets?
Yeah.
So true.
So many pockets.
You need a place for pens, phones, for paper clips, phones.
Everything.
Your own stuff, other people's stuff.
And one of my favorite anecdotes from the immigration team was that they were very, like, high femme. So the Secret Service used to call us Charlie's Angels because our office was across the street. We were in Lafayette Park in one of the Jackson House place, like,
nice office
houses.
Space. Mm-hmm.
And so we would walk across and Secret Service would be like, Charlie's Angels are coming, because these women, you know, these women I worked for, they would wear like white fishnets and clothing that I didn't associate with sort of spaces of political power. And that was really empowering. It was really cool to see. And I think that's how gender sort of had to show up in really formal spaces was something I learned a lot about.
There was, tell me, I'm wrong, but I vaguely remember, I think it had to have been the first Obama tour. There was something about, or is he listening to enough women, or does he have enough women? There was a meeting, and he sat down with, I'm assuming Valerie Jarrett organized it. Am I getting that right?
You are getting it right, just because Valerie's my boss, so I've heard her, or was my boss, so I've heard her tell this story many times. So I only know it from, you know, how she told it, but she wanted to make sure that at the highest levels that there was a culture of really making sure women were listened to, and so she got a bunch of senior women together at the White House along with President Obama, and it was just a chance for them to talk to him and kind of talk about the culture of what was going on and to hopefully set forth a good one. And I think that really relays the importance of how significant it is for culture to change from the very top, right? It has to come from the very top in order to really be influential.
Yeah. Okay, so two of you were got internships, which turns into jobs, right?
Yep.
Okay, yes. So 1,000 years ago, I got an internship, which turned into a job, and then Vice President Bush's office. How did you turn your internship into a job? Very real, very practical. How'd you do it? Taylor first.
For me, there was actually about a year of a break after my internship where I had to go and get a paying job. And
eating is always an attractive thing.
Yeah. My parents were ready for that. And I got a call to come back and interview for a position once it opened. But I think the short and simple was I just kept in touch with the people that I was working with and let them know that I would come back in a heartbeat if anything opened up. And, you know, underlying that is that I did a good job at the internship.
And you worked your tail off.
Yes.
I'll put the words in your mouth. Right? Yeah. Kalisha, you too?
Yeah. So the hard piece of advice I would give is skip the coffees. I skipped the coffees. So a lot of interns, it was all about how many people you could get coffees with, how many people you could sit down with for 30 minutes, how high of a level they can be at. I didn't have coffee with anyone. I sat at my desk. I grind it out until 10, 11 o'clock most days. And your work product and what you're doing speaks for everything. That will get you the job, not the 30 minutes of coffee.
Yeah, and just the hard work and grit of the place, just being there and working hard and being available is huge. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we'll get you guys out with this one. Mm-hmm. We talked a little bit about this beforehand. What were, for each one of you, and we'll go in reverse order, and you got to go catch a plane. So actually, you get to go first.
Yes, let her go first.
What was the story you wanted to include, but there just wasn't space?
This is a good one. One of the stories.
Well, we'll decide that.
Okay. I mean, it was a good question.
Okay, so, thank you. Yes.
Not being in a policy shop, my office didn't write policy, right? Our job was to kind of edit everyone else's materials and make sure that it.
Tell them how their memo sucked and yeah.
Yeah. But one of the things our office did get to handle was the Presidential Medal of Freedom, PMOF. And that was something that kind of, you know, had a lot of input from senior staffers, but it was our job to make sure at the end of the day that it was representative and that we were thinking about diverse backgrounds and making sure that it was very inclusive. And so our last year, one of the fun things was Joe Biden actually got a Presidential Medal of Freedom. Mm-hmm. And it was a project that we had helped work on. And so it was so exciting to kind of help put that together and, you know, make sure that his family was all there and that we were doing it as a surprise and that no one was going to spill the beans and that he wouldn't know. And so for me, it was putting that together and then seeing the actual moment when he got PMOF and it just the face that... The facial expression, it was amazing, right? It was so rewarding to be able to know that something that we had done had made such an impact on a person and a really well-deserved person.
Nice. How do you pick his chances, 2020?
I'm not ready to weigh in.
Okay. Taylor, you're next.
One of my favorite memories of working in the White House would not have been a great story because it has nothing to do with actual working, but it was the day that the decision on gay marriage came down from the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. And there was applause in the hallways and everyone kind of ended up running over to the Rose Garden. And, you know, normally Secret Service depends what badge you have and it's not an all access place. Mm-hmm. But that day they were kind of just hands up, come on in, everybody.
Nice.
And the president made live remarks from there. And it was just a beautiful moment and celebratory day for our country.
Oh, it's a lovely moment. Lovely. Okay, Andrea.
I think I would have written about, it's a depressing moment, I think.
Okay, bring us down.
Yeah, my chapter is, one of the ways Molly got me to do this book was I was like, I want to be very honest about how complicated it was to work on immigration in the mm-hmm. Obama White House. And one of the most memorable moments for me was when we reached this 2 million deportation mark. And why it was memorable was because, you know, we as a Democratic Party, I think our relationship to immigration policy, it's constantly evolving. But in that moment, there were so many people who joined that administration wanting to do the right thing for immigration, recognizing that it's, you know, inextricably linked to, like, the Latinx community and how we are seen as American or not seen as American. And so... It was really difficult to be there. It was after the Senate immigration bill had passed, and to see how advocates responded, and we were called, that was when the president was called deporter in chief. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. you know, we were the immigration team, and we had to address and make an argument to the country why we were still the party of immigration reform, why we still were the party of, you know, diversity and representation, and why we believe that immigrants are critical to identity, with the reality that it's also an enforcement, a law enforcement system. And I think it's important to tell young adults, and my chapter is a little more depressing than the rest, that you can go in and you can be, you know, whatever party you are, you can really believe in the ideals and feel like you're there at the right moment, and you can definitely fail, but you're part of a longer story of change that you can be proud of serving in and setting a foundation.
That's a book. That's not a chapter. That'd be a lot to cover in a chapter.
Maybe considering.
Yeah. No, you should. You really should. Okay, Kalisha?
So I spoke most about my role as policy advisor to the White House Council on Women and Girls because that's where I spent most of my time. I wish I could have dug in more to the job I had right before then, after my internship, which was on the president's intergovernmental affairs team, and I was working with his liaisons to state elected officials and, most importantly, our nation's governors. And I think that it was just a different role, mm-hmm. and I think would have more, I mean, really interestingly, in addition to, you know, my race, my gender, being young, I was also working with people on a day-to-day who politically did not agree with me, right? I think 32 of the nation's governors were Republicans at that time. Mm-hmm. And I also wasn't, like, a super political person. I was a policy person, right? So I think it was really just a lot of cool stories about how I worked with people very different from me and learned a lot along the way in doing mm-hmm. so.
Yeah, those are terrific. Awesome. Okay, we could go on forever and ever, but we can't because Nita has to catch a plane. So Taylor, Nita, sorry. Kalisha, Andrea, thank you so much.
Thank
Bill Isaacson,
coming.
Thank you so much for connecting us. Yes. The book is Yes, She Can. Everyone should get this. Graduations are coming up. This is a fabulous graduation gift.
I love that.
Absolutely fabulous graduation gift. And when you all go on to write more books about these topics and others, come back.
Yes,
we'll
please.
Be here. We absolutely will be here. We're going to take a break. We're going to need a run for the airport. We are going to come back with our segment, which authors, dead or alive, you would take to a deserted island. Anybody wants to stay, if you have ideas, we'll include you.
And we have wine.
And we have wine.
Lots of
from
wine.
From CW.
And cheese.
Okay. We'll be back.
Thank you so much.
It does kind of get you after a while.
What's
the music kind of grabs you after a while. Yeah, it's kind of catchy. I like it.
You'd be mad when you listen.
Okay, so we are back. We've lost one of our fabulous authors from Yes, She Can on her way to the airport. BWI, that was interesting, David. Very interesting. Instead of taking a book to the deserted island this time, we're going to take an author or two, and you get the assignment is, which we did not tell the ladies about in advance, you get to take an author or two to spend time with you on the deserted island. Who would like to go first?
I'll go first.
David?
I really thought about this. I thought long and hard about this, and I thought...
Did you like this better than the regular Deserted Island segment?
Well, yeah, because I'm not smart,
we're out of
and
books.
I don't have any more books.
Yeah, you can repeat.
I've gone through my shelf of three.
Exactly. I have no more books. So I thought about this. I thought, well, John Grisham's a great author, you know, and I thought about Toni Morrison's a great author, and then I thought, you're really overthinking this. I'm taking Julia Child with me so that she can tell me how
brilliant.
To cook all the food on the island.
Brilliant. Mine's a variation.
Oh, Michael.
Oh, I cut the dickens out of my finger.
Do you know I met some retired spooks who knew Julia Child well in her day? So they're older.
She was a spy.
They couldn't stand her. They
what?
Hated that. Well, they hated that she became a media hog about being a former spook.
Yeah.
Michael?
I took this in a different direction. I wanted to see who I was going to have fun with on the island.
Good.
So I actually went. I went with P.G. Wodehouse. So this is a sort of a humor writer, mid-20th century. But I wanted someone who's going to write about my favorite gentleman of leisure, Bertram Wooster, and his ever-correct butler, Jeeves.
Jeeves.
And this was before Ask Jeeves. But I was actually just thinking one of my favorite lines, which is, it just out of context, it's so small, but it's just so perfect to capture this world. So this is from the Code of Woosters. I could see that, if not actually disgruntled, he was far from being gruntled. No one gets into more trouble than Bertie Wooster. No one gets into more misplaced engagements, has worse aunts than Bertram than Bertie, but he's always down for a good lunch and a good lunch. Evening
nice.
Aperitif before dinner.
Nice.
So I'm going to P.G. Wodehouse. And then my second, this is maybe because of Game of Thrones from last night. But I was thinking back to my favorite fantasy series that I've mentioned on the show before, Name of the Wind. And I'd actually love to bring Patrick Rothfuss with me. One, because he hasn't finished book three.
Yes,
and I have a feeling I might be looking forward to reading this on the island. Two, the game Tack, which is this game of strategy and sort of human psychology in A Wise Man's Fear, which is book two.
Mm-hmm.
He could help recreate that game. And if I'm stuck on a desert island, I think I'm going to have to go deep into the heart of stone to try and control my emotions. No, he seems to love pop culture, music. He's just
good entertainment.
Interesting guy.
Yeah, good. Okay. Andrea?
I would take a poet because I think if you're on a deserted island, you'd get really reflective about the state of humanity. And so I'd take W.S. Merwin, who just passed away, but wrote some of my favorite poetry and also was just like an expert in talking about nature, and I think it would be a really just fascinating experience. And in another life, I'd be a poet.
Nice. Well, you could do that in this
exactly.
life, too.
What's wrong with this
plenty
life?
Plenty of time.
I'm focusing on litigation right
ladies.
Now.
Ladies.
Focusing Taylor and Kalisha?
I would probably take Nora Ephron.
Good.
Just because I feel like she would keep it real.
So highly entertaining.
And would always have something to say.
Right.
Yeah,
that's true.
Good. Kalisha?
Very true.
I know you passed on Toni, but I'm going to go ahead and take
okay.
Toni
yes.
Morrison because I trust her to just save the world.
Yeah.
Good one.
There you go.
Mark?
Well, you can see my list. I was writing down here. I have one crossed off, and it should be Hunter S. Thompson. Because I know the doctor and I would have just a fabulous time, but would, that probably needs to be in Vegas.
Involve because, some substances.
Yeah, because we'd need supplies. Yeah, and coconuts ain't going to cut it. So I got Jack London down there, just because I think Jack London's one of the most fascinating guys.
Jack
London. You know, and just because he went out and he lived his life. Yeah. Like, he wasn't, like, writing about it. He's like, I was an oyster fisherman, off in San Francisco Bay, and then I went to the Yukon, and I did all these things. Like, he was out there living it. So I've always loved Jack London.
Right.
And then the other guy is another guy that lived it and then wrote about it, and that's Winston Churchill. Now, a lot of people don't know or have forgotten the fact that he wrote a book called The River War about the Boer War in the late 19th century, and then obviously wrote the definitive history of the Second World War and the leading up to it, the Gathering Storm, all that stuff. And honestly, you guys know how I'm wired. And Churchill to me is about the coolest guy ever. I need to have healthy supply of cigars and brandy, you know. But I think I can't think of two better people to be on the island.
There you go. Tor.
Churchill's so self-centered, though. Right. It would all be about him. Tell me more about me. Him. Exactly. It'd be all about him. So I would take Tom Wolfe. Just a great storyteller.
Yeah. Almost great
storyteller.
Yes. Yes.
And we had her on this show. I would take Cokie Roberts. Okay. She's funny. Yeah. She's smart. She has a great sense of history. And I'm pretty sure she's a good cook. So kind of Julia Childs. I think having a...
Because all we got is leaves and sand.
Exactly. I think she could make something out of that.
Make something happen.
Okay, great show. Ladies, thank you very, very much for being with
us.
Thank you. Good luck with the book. Write more. Yes, she can. Everyone should buy this. This is their latest graduation present. Mark, we are out of here. We're going to come back next week, and we are going to have Abby Maslin on, who is truly remarkable. This is a local story. She is the author of Love You Hard, a memoir of marriage, brain injury, and reinventing love. I've read the book. I listened to it driving to and from places this past weekend. It's really, really something. It's a remarkable book. And so we look forward to having her. And thanks, everybody. Thanks, Dustin. Thanks for the gang.
Yes.
See you next week.
See you.